Coming up is the news.
People in the southwestern Iranian city of Izeh hold a funeral for the victims of Wednesday's terror attack there. The U.S. gives immunity to Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman from legal action over the 2018 murder of dissident journalist Jamal Khashoggi. And Russia accuses the U.S. of testing the patience of North Korea as tensions keep simmering on the Korean Peninsula. Welcome. Thank you for joining us. My name is Gisumi Shahmadi, and these are our top stories this hour. People in the southwestern Iranian city of Izeh have held a funeral for the victims of Wednesday's terror attack there. Mourners expressed their grief for the victims while at the same time slamming those behind the deadly assault. Two gunmen shot at people in central Izeh, Kurdistan province. Seven people, including a child, lost their lives as a result. 10 more were injured. Also, last month, a terror attack took place at a revered shrine in Iran's southern city of Shiraz, leaving over a dozen people dead. The assaults came on the heels of recent riots in Iran. Tehran says terrorists have taken advantage of the wave of unrest and rioting, which are hatched and staged by foreign-backed elements. Iran's Vice President for Economic Affairs, Mohsen Rezai, attended the funeral at Izeh. He said the country will take revenge against all of those behind the terror attack. Rezai made the comments as he addressed people taking part in the funeral procession. He said the United States is attempting to foment insecurity in Iran. Those attempts, he added, are in line with America's policy to exert pressure on Iran through imposing sanctions. The Iranian official said the U.S. is resorting to creating unrest in Iran because Tehran has already managed to mitigate the effects of the sanctions. University professor Mohammad Marandi says foreign governments have used their agents inside Iran to ruthlessly murder innocent people, but put the blame on the Iranian government.
Over the last 2-3 days, we've seen an upsurge in the number of police officers and Basij members massacred by these thugs in Esfahan, in Mashhad, in Bukhan, and of course in Izeh. Now, what is unique about Izeh is that now these thugs that have murdered these innocent people and injured police officers, they are alongside the Persian media based in London and Western countries trying to blame the government for these murders. And it's clear who benefits from these acts. It's obvious which countries benefit from the death of innocent people in Iran. So we have to make, I think the government has to start changing its policy. And those governments that are behind this, those Western governments and those regional governments that are behind this, have to pay a heavy price. This is the continuation of these policies where the police are left vulnerable, the Basij are left vulnerable, is unacceptable.
Tehran has condemned an anti-Iran IAEA resolution saying it is, quote, unacceptable, politically motivated, and unconstructive. Iran's envoy to the International Atomic Energy Agency, Mohsen Naziri Asla, said the move may, quote, affect cooperation with the IAEA and paves the way for more unilateral sanctions against the Islamic Republic. He said the Western sponsors of the resolution put heavy pressure on other members of the IAEA Board of Governors to get the motion approved. The Iranian envoy urged the UN nuclear agency to adopt an independent, impartial, and professional approach. The motion submitted by the United States, Britain, France, and Germany calls on Iran to fully cooperate with the agency. resolution is associated with an IAEA probe into what it terms the presence of, quote, uranium traces at three undeclared sites in Iran. University Professor Fahd Izzati says the West's confrontational approach will backfire in the long run as it gives Iran cold feet to voluntarily cooperate with the UN nuclear agency.
You know, I think the real motive behind this resolution is actually to force Iranian officials to stop cooperating with the agency. They want to take the case to the UN Security Council, and by passing this type of politically motivated resolutions, they want to basically create a scene where Iran, given the fact that these type of resolutions are politically motivated, it stops its cooperation with IAEA. In practice, what will happen is that Iran will follow NPT guidelines when it comes to IAEA cooperation, but Iran will do the absolute minimum, nothing more than what is required. Yeah, so this type of practice is actually going to backfire in the long run, because the access, the extra access that Iran was providing under the JCPOA is going to disappear totally. And it's going to be the other side that's going to lose the access that they had more than what Iran was supposed to do. And if they push further, I think Iranian officials will take extra measures to make sure that anti-Iran resolutions has a cost for the countries that sponsor.
Washington has moved to shield the Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman from accountability over the 2018 murder of Jamal Khashoggi. The administration of President Joe Biden says bin Salman is now the Prime Minister of Saudi Arabia and therefore is immune from legal action. Khashoggi's fiance has expressed a great saying that he has been murdered once again. Also, UN-based NGO calling itself Democracy for the Arab World warned that Washington's latest move has basically licensed bin Salman to kill more dissidents. Khashoggi, who was a U.S.-based journalist, was brutally murdered at the Saudi consulate in Istanbul. According to U.S. intelligence assessments, bin Salman ordered the killing. Khashoggi was a strong critic of the Saudi regime. South Korea says the neighboring North has made its second weapons launch in 2 days, firing a suspected intercontinental ballistic missile towards the Sea of Japan. According to the South Korean military, the latest missile flew 1,000 kilometers and reached an altitude of almost 6,100. On Thursday, North Korea tested a short-range ballistic missile as well. The National Security Council in Seoul has already met to discuss the latest developments. Japan has also confirmed the latest launch, saying that the missile fell in the waters in its exclusive economic zone. Tokyo says this was probably an ICBM and it can reach a U.S. mainland.
We analyzed the flight trajectory of the ICBM-class missile that was launched this time, and depending on the warhead and weight of the missile, it had a flying capability of over 15,000 kilometers, which means it had enough range to reach United States mainland.
The U.S. has strongly condemned North Korea's missile test, calling it a brazen violation of U.N. Security Council resolutions. Russia, in the meantime, has accused the U.S. of testing North Korea's patience. Pyongyang has fired a barrage of missiles in recent months in response to what it describes as U.S. hostilities. The North says its missile program is for self-defense. The country is strongly critical of joint military drills frequently held by Washington and Seoul. The latest such drills took place earlier this month. Pyongyang says they are a rehearsal for an invasion. Our correspondent Jennifer Chang is in Seoul. She explains why North Korea has conducted its latest test and what it means to the U.S.
This test came after a regional gathering in Cambodia recently, at which the U.S. President Joe Biden held a summit with the Japanese Prime Minister and the South Korean President and pledged to defend South Korea and Japan with the full range of U.S. military weapons, including nuclear weapons. But if the North holds U.S. cities hostage with a nuclear-tipped ICBM, there's little that the U.S. can do to defend South Korea. This is what many experts are saying. The Hwasong-17, fired successfully today by the North, can carry multiple warheads, including decoys, capable of evading U.S. missile defenses. And the nuclear warhead would just be one of those decoys. It would be one weapon mixed in with those decoys. And it would be impossible to tell which is a decoy and which is a nuclear warhead. So the U.S. would be helpless to defend a U.S. city against a North Korean ICBM tipped with a nuclear warhead.
Soaring prices in Japan have hit the wallets of consumers as the inflation peaks its highest level in nearly four decades. Core consumer prices, excluding fresh food, increased by 3.6% in October compared to a year ago. That is according to data by the Japanese government. High prices of energy and raw materials, as well as a weak national currency, are to blame for the high inflation. Chief Cabinet Secretary says that it has taken a toll on people's basic needs. Japan's central bank is resisting tilting to a tightening monetary policy. It says there is no need to raise interest rates, a move that some experts believe would help stave off inflation in recent months. Some central banks, like the U.S. Federal Reserve, have raised interest rates to contain inflation. World leaders are in Thailand in the capital, Bangkok, to attend a summit of the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation, or APEC. Chinese President Xi Jinping and U.S. Vice President Kamala Harris are among the participants at the summit. The two-day gathering discusses sustainable economic growth and trade. The war in Ukraine is on the agenda, too. Thailand has called for putting aside differences and focusing on resolving pressing global economic issues such as inflation. APEC member states consist of a third of the global population. They make up 62% of gross domestic product and nearly half of the global trade. Investigations point to Ukraine's involvement in Tuesday's missile explosion on Poland's soil, but Washington and Kiev insist Moscow is to blame for the deadly incident. During our news review program, this is what we focused on. Let's take a listen.
Jenny Miller is our correspondent joining us from Donetsk. We also have Gilbert Doctorow, who's an independent international affairs analyst, joining us from Brussels. Welcome to you both. So, Jenny Miller, first over to you. Obviously, this was something that needed the U.N. Security Council's attention, but at this point, how do things stand?
Well, originally, Ukraine and NATO officials, also one unnamed source in the American intelligence community, blamed Russia for this strike on Poland. But now it seems very clear and admitted, at least by NATO, that it was a Ukrainian missile that hit Poland. Interestingly, we're seeing here now the largest divide that we've seen yet between NATO and Ukraine. I'll read a quote here from the Financial Times, a journalist there, who says that in Kiev, a NATO a diplomat said to him, "This is getting ridiculous. The Ukrainians are destroying our confidence in them. Nobody is blaming Ukraine, and they are openly lying. This is more destructive than the missile, because the Ukrainians are still saying that it was a Russian missile, whereas NATO are admitting that it wasn't." There has been some backtracking on that today from Zelensky. But why this is very dangerous, and indeed many of the front pages of Western newspapers originally ran with the headline that Russia had attacked Poland. This, of course, could operate the Article 5 of NATO's treaty, basically potentially starting a war between Russia and NATO, potentially a nuclear war. But, of course, that story turned out to be fake. So now Ukraine is slowly backtracking from that. There's also been a major loss of credibility from certain Western newspapers who have been reporting that this was these were Russian missiles, when actually it turns out now they were Ukrainian. But it also brings into focus the threat of a miscalculation here or a mistake that could bring Russia and NATO into war together.
Indeed. So you have the miscalculation threat on the one hand, Gilbert Doctorow. On the other hand, I'm curious as to whether two things could have happened here to have triggered the Article 5 and whether we would have seen a response. First of all, they could have said, no, this was a Russian missile, because we know that they lie. And they could have gone ahead with it. And I'm asking you whether that would have been a possibility. On the other hand, what if it was a Russian missile or two that landed in Poland? Do you think that NATO would have that Article 5 triggered, and would a war have erupted between NATO and Russia?
This event was extremely interesting, if we can step back a minute from the threat to our existence that was implicit in what the Kievan regime was saying. The intent on the part of Mr. Zelensky was clearly to push Poland and the United States, NATO, into a more active support, if not invoking Article 5, then at least Article 4, and preparing the way for what would be a hot war between NATO and Russia. The Russians immediately after the event called this a provocation on the part of Mr. Zelensky and the Ukrainians, and that has not been explored fully for reasons that would be very embarrassing for the U.S. side. Provocation because if this were indeed an air defense missile, it should have been fired to the east and to the north, from where Russian incoming cruise missiles would be coming. Instead, it was fired due west. So, if he wants ultimately into a hot war with Russia, and it failed. It failed in a way that similar potential false flag operations did not see.
Thanks for tuning in.
That brings us to the end of this edition of World News.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Current world order will be replaced by a new order where US is isolated, Asia powerful, resistance front expanded. This is the part of a speech delivered by the leader of the Islamic Revolution during a meeting with students on Wednesday, November 2nd, 2022. This meeting was held on the occasion of National Students' Day and National Day of Fighting Against Global Arrogance, which are commemorated on the 13th of Aban, 4th of November. This day is an important day for us, but it also really agitates the Americans. So those who think that the US is an untouchable power when we look at the events that took place on this day, it becomes evident that this is not the case. That is completely vulnerable. This turns into an experience for us. Three events took place on this day, some of which are directly related to the Americans, and others are indirectly related to them. One event was the exile of Imam Khomeini, which took place on the 13th of Aban, November 4, 1964, pro-American law.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Why was Imam Khomeini sent into exile? Because a law was ratified by the direct order of the Shah, Muhammad Reza Pahlavi, to the parliament of that day. According to that law, the Americans who were in Iran were granted immunity. There were about 40 to 50,000 Americans in Iran, and the military, security, and economic organizations. According to this law, if these individuals committed any sort of crime in Iran, they couldn't be prosecuted. So, for example, if an American happened to run someone over while driving their car, the judicial system of the country had no right to prosecute them. This was the immunity law of the Americans. Imam Khomeini did not tolerate this. He gave a long speech, his voice recording, and the text of this speech are available today. Because of this speech, he was exiled for 13 years. We say 13 years because the revolution happened at the end of these 13 years. If the revolution hadn't taken place, this period of exile might have even lasted 30 years because of his opposition to this pro-American law.
You've done for me through all my years I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
Is be true to what you said on paper.
We won't back down.
Stop the witches!
Turn here now.
We will resist.
I can't breathe. Help me. Please.
We the people.
Some Americans have gone to polling stations across the country and voted in midterm elections. Certain Americans of voting age, like those with felonies, are not eligible to vote in most states. Now, these Americans account for 2% of the voting population. For more than a century, less than half of eligible voters in America have gone to polling stations and voted in midterm elections. Now, these statistics are worse for minorities. One main reason for the low turnouts is that voters do not feel represented in Congress. Now, this feeling is also reflected in congressional approval ratings taken each month.
Who will you represent?
Hello, everyone, and welcome to We the People. I am your host, Daniel Arya. In this episode, we will discuss midterm elections, voter turnout statistics in the United States, and why most Americans do not vote in midterm elections. We will speak about voter suppression and explore who the members of Congress really represent. And as usual, we are pleased to have our two guests on our show, Daniel Burke, who is a former candidate for the U.S. Senate, and Robert Patillo, who is a political strategist. Stay tuned.
For more than a century, more than half of the American population did not vote in midterm elections. A country that has been calling itself the beacon of democracy is unable to even draw half of the voting population to its polling stations. Normally, the turnout has been even less than 40%, and when it has been more than that percentage, the main reason is usually due to some extraordinary event. Experts believe that in recent years, the relative rise in votes has been attributed mostly to the radical supporters of Trump on the one hand and Trump's opposers on the other, who feel they have so much at stake if Trump and his allies return to power. The status of American participation in elections for more than a century makes Biden's comments on democracy look more like a joke.
My fellow Americans, please, if you have a seat, take it. I speak to you tonight from sacred ground in America, Independence Hall in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. This is where America made its Declaration of Independence to the world more than two centuries ago, with an idea unique among nations, that in America, we're all created equal. This is where the United States Constitution was written and debated. This is where we set in motion the most extraordinary experiment of self-government the world has ever known.
Now, according to the United States Elections Project, which is an information source for the U.S. electoral system, since 1916, there has not been a midterm election with more than 50% turnout. Now, more than half the midterms after that period have had less than 40% turnout, and normally a low turnout is attributed to a belief that there is no meaningful difference in which candidate or party you vote for. So do Americans care to vote in midterm elections?
Well, I mean, you have to put it in the context that in any normal presidential election, you have perhaps 35% and usually more of the population that doesn't vote at all. The population is actually eligible to vote. In the midterm elections, this goes down even further. And so what you mostly have is people who come out who are politically engaged, who want to, largely they want to punish the political party that succeeded in the presidential elections. They want to express their discontent. And that's generally what you've got right now in the United States, that the will is the vote against someone and not the vote for something. I think that's what we're going to see in the midterms.
Now, American political hypocrisy is very consistent. While it is seen time and again, the U.S. officials and politicians criticize other countries for their democratic status or their voter turnout, the U.S. voter turnout is much lower than many countries. Now, mayoral elections in the country are even worse than the midterms. For instance, in 2019, Philadelphia's mayor was elected with just 27% turnout and Chicago's with just 35%. So why do only a few Americans vote in U.S. elections?
I think part of the issue in America is that we are one of the few countries that has a two-party system. In many other countries, you have a parliamentary system where you have multiple parties, and then those parties form a coalition in order to create a government. In America, by contrast, you only have two parties representing the quote-unquote left and quote-unquote right of the political spectrum. Many people feel left out of that process. And let's say if I'm an environmentalist who is also a fiscal conservative, there's not really a party for that group in America. And because of this, many people are just disenfranchised and disenchanted with the political process to the point that they stay home on election day. I think that we're seeing those numbers slowly shift because, simply put, the importance of these elections and the amount of money being spent to mobilize people to vote. But I think because we only have a two-party system, that's why the result is so few people voting in elections.
In terms of demographics, U.S. voters are usually older, wealthier, and white. African-American and Latino voters vote less than white voters do. Representatives also tend to support policy in favor of this demographic group. Minorities that feel neglected and unrepresented in the country's political establishment will become politically disengaged. According to a 538 IPSOS poll, those who never vote tend to be low income, young, and not belonging to any political party.
Increasing cynicism and distrust in the U.S. government from the American population. I mean, it's been going on for decades that people see the deindustrialization of the United States. They see the foreign entanglements, the insane regime change wars that have provided nothing but pain for the world and for the United States population. And there's every time that a character comes along that promises hope and change, it turns out that they have merely continued in this type of participation in horrific wars and destruction of economy. So people are appropriately depressed about that. But what we actually need in the United States is for people to come forward and recognize an affirmative conception, an affirmative policy to solve that. The last time anyone talked about that in a sincere way was Trump and his campaign. But then, of course, his sincerity was quite in question when the result of his presidency was a continuation of those policies.
It is not just that most Americans do not want to vote, but there is a large population that is not allowed to. In the November midterm elections, an estimated 2% of the voting age population are ineligible to vote because of laws banning people with felony convictions from voting. According to a report published by the Sentencing Project, the population of those who are ineligible to vote due to a felony is close to 5 million.
And that is not all. Some policies also make it more difficult for people to vote. About one-fifth of the adult American population, which is about 48 million people, struggle to read at a basic level. And now some states have made it even more difficult for volunteers to help those who struggle to read to cast their ballots. In Georgia, Olivia Coley Pearson, who has helped voters for years, was arrested in 2020 when she was helping voters who struggle to read at the polls.
Well, the problem is that congresspeople and senators truly represent the special interest groups. As I said, over $1.5 billion have been spent on this election thus far, and thus the people who are elected mainly represent the moneyed political interests, the special interest groups, the donors who are able to finance their campaigns, as opposed to the American people. It's now impossible for a normal person of average means to get elected just on a campaign representing the people. You have to have enough money, even on the state and local level, to put television ads up, to hire campaign consultants to charge over $100,000 a year, to put together field teams and operations and buses and vans, etc.
Voter suppression is a tactic used by some politicians or parties to discourage or prevent groups of people from voting in hope of getting elected. Historically, only white male landowners had the right to vote. But when women, African Americans, and other minorities won their right to vote, American politicians came up with other strategies to try and suppress those voters in districts that they believed would vote against them.
Yes, we do have a long way to go to get all of the people registered of voting age, but if we can get 500 registered today, this would be a magnificent step forward.
Voter suppression has been a part of the United States political scene since the nation's inception.
Some politicians try to win re-elections by making it harder for certain populations, demographics, and communities to vote. A common strategy is to reduce polling locations and also polling station times by having them open only during business hours. The day of the midterm elections is not a public holiday, and many low-income workers will not be able to get the day off to go to polling stations and cast their vote during business hours.
The key thing right now is that the people in political power in the United States, in the mainstream uniparty, war party situation, they want to keep Americans demoralized. They want to keep them that way so that they can be controlled. They want to keep them distracted as much as possible. And therefore, they don't want them engaged in politics except when they're absolutely required to turn out votes to get their candidate in. And right now, I think if you look at the past several weeks, some friends of mine have been involved in interventions, and many people that I've never met before have interrupted leading politicians. For example, Barack Obama, Mike Pompeo, and earlier Kamala Harris, recently Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Elizabeth Warren, and have demanded of them that they take account of the extraordinary danger of thermonuclear war, which has been created by their policies. The coup in Ukraine in 2014 and everything since then leading into the special military operation by Russia and Ukraine, what is much more than a proxy war between NATO and Russia. Now with American boots on the ground, so-called, in Ukraine, we are really in the midst of World War III, and we have to prevent it from going thermonuclear. We have to stop this insanity.
Now, another strategy that politicians use is gerrymandering. Gerrymandering is the manipulation of electoral district boundaries to create an advantage for a specific party. For instance, Democrats try to construct coalition districts of liberals and minorities together with conservatives that results in Democratic-leaning districts. Now, Republicans try to place liberals together in a district and conservatives in others to create clear partisan districts.
Voter suppression is one of the most important issues in American politics that the political right, for some reason, pretends does not exist. Voter suppression is the process by which you make it more difficult for individuals at the lower end of the economic spectrum and the social spectrum in America to vote. And by doing this, you're able to skim off votes that makes it easier for parties that lack majority power to be able to win. So when people talk about voter suppression, they think that it's, you know, someone standing outside of the polls with a fire hose and dogs, not letting anybody vote. When in reality, it is really just trying to get one out of every 100 voters to not vote.
When American politicians mostly represent the white, wealthy community, it is no surprise that they would have no interest in the rest of the population to vote. The New York Times reported in September that 97 members of the Congress had reported trade in companies influenced by their committees. When contacted, many of them have said that the trade had been carried out by a spouse or broker with no input from them.
There is every effort made to prevent legitimate ideas and concerns, a passion for the general welfare, to come forward. Look at the case of Chuck Schumer. He's the U.S. Senator from New York. Right now, he is challenged by Diane Sayre, an independent candidate for U.S. Senate, if the LaRouche was right party. And she is the only independent candidate who was able to get on the ballot with extraordinary ballot requirements, 66,000 petition signatures she turned in for a 45,000 petition signature requirement, which is absolutely gigantic relative to the rest of the country. I ran for U.S. Senate in New Jersey, and I needed 800 signatures. So this required a very significant operation of volunteers and supporters. And what happened? She's been kept out of the debate, that major debate that took place between the Republican candidate and Chuck Schumer. And she's been placed on a Ukrainian hit list, which was financed by the U.S. or supported by the U.S. government, with votes that were made by Chuck Schumer to send tens of billions of dollars to Ukraine, including to support their civil government. And that list was organized by the Ukrainian government to label people on it info-terrorists, who they claimed, the Ukrainian government representative, should be treated as war criminals.
When the loyalty of politicians lies with campaign donors and lobbyists, it is no wonder people would not be interested in voting. Representatives are not allowed to receive gifts of value from lobbyists. So instead of receiving funds directly, they hold campaign fundraising events at holiday location resorts and receive contribution from lobbyists who fly over to the event and use that contribution to pay for their hotel, airfare, and catering bills.
We are often campaigning toward the lowest common denominator in America. Instead of having these kind of high-minded ideas of democracy and of exceptionalism pushing the nation forward, it very much comes down to a question of who do you dislike the least? You're not voting for the better candidate, but the lesser of two evils which are running. So because of this, you have a lot of voters who feel that they are not spoken to. We have something called the Citizens United case that was decided in the year 2010, which allowed unlimited money to come into American politics. This unlimited money meant unlimited influence for the rich, powerful, and well-connected. And we see this in American politics as it currently is constituted.
With all the dirty politics surrounding the election of members of Congress, it's not surprising that the Congress's approval rating is almost always very low. Now, according to recent polls conducted by the Gallup, only 23% of Americans approve, while 75% disapprove the way Congress is handling its job. Now, this is while the monthly poll shows that since January of 2021, the approval rating has always been lower than 40%, with a high of 36% and a low of 16% in June. So why does Congress have such a low approval rating?
Well, if you look at it, America has a system that is built to do nothing. Our founders were so concerned about one party or one branch of government becoming too powerful and then producing tyranny on the public, that they create a system of checks and balances, which is now turned into a system of gridlock. In order to get anything signed into law, you have to have something passed by the House of Representatives, then it goes to the Senate, it has to pass the Senate, then it goes back through a process where you bring the bills together, where both sides vote on it.
The Gallup polls show that approval ratings for the Congress has almost always been low since 1975. There has only been a spike around 2001, just after the September 11 attacks on the World Trade Center. Interestingly, the approval is attributed to Congress Joint Resolution that authorized the use of the United States Armed Forces against those responsible for the September 11 attacks.
Now, with the exception of a few elections driven by severe and harsh partisan political campaigns, most midterm elections in the U.S. are dull and most Americans do not care to participate. Low turnout showed political disengagement by the majority of the population, but it also might be what many American politicians truly want. While serving their own interests and being loyal only to wealthy corporations, the two major U.S. political parties will most likely continue to use dirty tactics for winning elections at any cost. Now it's time to see what Abbas Mutarim has prepared for us this week.
Every election season, like clockwork, we're told to get out and vote by the powers that be. And that we have a certain responsibility to do this for the betterment of quote unquote American society. But simply saying to just get out and vote, it's really just political immaturity at its finest. Because political change doesn't just come from voting and participating in politics one day every voting season. And in reality, this simple act of voting, it's really just a bourgeoisie instrument for making change in the settler colony. In this episode of Power to the People, we is going to take a look at voting and what it really means for the people. First and foremost, America, like its contradictory self, it claims to be a democracy, which means that the people have full control over the political institutions that govern them, which we know is not true at all, as it's corporations that govern daily life. So what does it mean? What does it mean that we are supposed to vote every election season? Can we actually make positive change through voting? Because positive change means egalitarianism and communalistic practices are put into the daily life. Well, to answer these questions, we must have a proper interpretation of history. And if we look at history, if we look at the current state of America, the American government itself is a settler colonial government that commits and continues to commit genocide against Black and Indigenous people. The U.S., it got all of its wealth from the enslavement of Africans. And what was the legal document that backed all of this? It's the so-called American Constitution. This same document is what governs the political, social, and economic life for America and its citizens. And it exercises control over its colonial subjects, as that's what we are as Black and Indigenous people. So each time that we are voting for change, in reality, we are voting to uphold this same genocidal settler colonial government. And while locally there's important measures and propositions that are on the ballot, corporate control over these elections makes it hard for measures or policies that have egalitarianism throughout it to actually pass. We must understand that we can't actually vote away settler colonialism, and we can't vote away a slave system. The whole system itself has to go. So that begs the question, what is real change and how do we get it? Well, real change, it's rooted in the culmination of positive energy of the people that is garnered in the name of humanity. And the highest culmination of all this positive energy can be simply described as revolution, which overthrows the corporate-ruled and controlled United States of America, and it installs a society in which egalitarianism and communalism is at its core. Simply put, the people are now in control of their destiny, and that's the way it should be. And the way we build this is by organizing amongst our people. We have to free our minds so that our bodies can follow. This means that we must politically educate ourselves, our households, our families, and our communities. And with proper political education, we then should develop an undying love for our people and communities. And with this undying love, we should become the change that we seek in our community, providing material resources and programming that brings positive change and love in our community into fruition. And once we see that we can embody love, then of course we will see that we can truly govern ourselves under these principles rather than the destructive principles of white supremacist capitalism. This is Power to the People. I'm Abbas Mutakine.
And that was the program, everyone. Thank you for watching. I'm your host, Daniel Arya. Do join us again next time for another episode of We the People. Goodbye for now.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
Self-purification is the most significant factor.
Imamat yek asl zinde ast dar tarikh Islam.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, Assalamu alaikum to you dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. Welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali. Stay tuned.
صادق به مفضل ابن عمر فرمود مفضل نعمت فراموشی بالاتر از نعمت حافظ است.
امام صادق علیه السلام in a beautiful narration addressing مفضل ابن عمر states, the blessing of forgetfulness is better than the blessing of memory. Of course, memory is in itself a big blessing. However, feeling forgetful, especially at the time of bad occasions, help you to reconstruct yourself spiritually.
مثلا اگر خبر ناگوار مرگی یکی از عزیزان رو بهت دادن، این همیشه تو دلت میموند.
For instance, if you are given the sad news of the death of one of your dear ones, you could not escape the consequences if you did not have the power to forget. In other words, you would always feel sad or annoyed. Thus, forgetting is a blessing. Just think how depressed people will be if they could not forget the sad moments of their lives. Therefore, both memory and forgetfulness are blessings, but the blessings of forgetting are more than memory. Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, parstoday.com/en, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
Midstream.
Iran has been facing a great siege and harsh sanctions imposed by the warmongering West, but it achieved self-sufficiency and came out victorious. The West then tried both soft and direct wars through external interventions to disrupt internal life in the Islamic Republic in the form of sedition schemes, terrorist movements, and media incitement, yet Iran revealed what's behind the Western masks. Of course, it is not possible to visualize the Iranian scene in isolation from the failure of the Zionist American axis in forming a reality that is consistent with their unattainable goals. However, that vision brings clarity as to who are the parties behind the riots and the systematic attacks on the Iranian people in supporting, planning, and funding rioters, from capitalizing on the case of the young woman Mahsa Amini to the fanatic bombings and the arrest of cells belonging to terrorist organizations. This has been the plan put forth by the administration of George Bush and continues to this day, a strategy that puts the United States of America in open conflict with Iran, Iraq, and Syria. It calls for concealing the role of the real motivators, actors, and organizers of forming an extremist and sectarian front, maintaining the secrecy of U.S. and Israeli support, and showing cooperation through Saudi networks, which are obsessed with Iran's role in the region. Hence, the scene today can be read in multiple directions, the most important of which is the decline of American hegemony during its wars since after the events of 9/11, in contrast to the growing power of its target, the Axis of Resistance in particular. This is factual despite its notorious policy of drowning its enemy in crises, as was evident in the 2006 Lebanon July War, the 2009 Gaza War, and the global war against Syria since 2011, all the way to the current Western-made events inside Iran. At this point, an important theme emerges that needs to be addressed, which is the birth of the New World Order, whose keys are in the hands of the Eurasian bloc, the bloc that threatens America's leadership and attempts to pull the rug of control from under its feet in West Asia. The nature of the successive changes on the Western Axis imposes on it to play in multiple arenas at a time when the nature of alliances is changing, orientated towards a more solid and ascending stage, including the main players in Asia, Iran, Russia, and China. This opened the way for their Western enemy to enter center stage with fabricated crises. What the Islamic Republic of Iran is being subjected to today strongly demonstrates the aggravation of Iran's enemies by its growing strength. This does come within the framework of Western malicious plans blatantly announced by the American intelligence departments and politicians. However, the confidence in the ability to repel these fabricated waves of Western aggression is far greater than what Iran's enemies might think. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. As the identity of the parties behind the riots and the systematic attacks against the Iranian people became clear, from the case of the late young woman Mahsa Amini to the bombings and the arrest of cells belonging to the terrorist organization Daesh, it was imperative to look back historically, and in particular, since after the Islamic Revolution in Iran in 1979, the United States of America has worked using the same tactic, that is divide and conquer, to expand its influence in West Asia through British-made radical groups, also supported by it and with American Arab facilitation. To discuss this issue with us from Tehran is Dr. Mustafa Khoshashm, academic and political commentator. Thank you for being with us, Mr. Khoshashm. Now, Iran's enemies tried concealing their role as real motivators, actors, and organizers of forming an extremist and sectarian front against the Islamic Republic and maintaining the secrecy of both American and Israeli support to terrorists who attempted to ignite Iran. Yet the Islamic Republic was able to dissect those behind the sabotage and expose the Western hegemony. What do you think Iran's next move will be?
This is a scheme that has been repeated and that has been underway by the United States whenever Iran and the United States are at a willpower, a war of willpower. Then the Americans start a pretty known and notorious formula against Iran that includes hybrid warfare. In more than a dozen areas, they try to fight against Iran indirectly in different areas of media, of foreign currency, of oil supplies to the foreign country.